week with respect to an announcement that CMHC had made, where they said that they would no longer insure mortgages where the equity was being drawn out by the property holder, unless that money is rechanneled back in to the building for improvements, or that money is used to buy another building. But they've not been clear on what the time frame would be for that. I spoke with CMHC yesterday or the day before and said that policy is going to wipe out the retirement plans for all the small to medium property owners, because we won't be able to take the money out that we spent years building. And they said they'd get back to me. If you have more questions on that, I can always get, you know, I'll provide you more details later, but we're now at 10 o'clock, so we'll get started, I guess.
Yeah, perfect, Chris. I've had one quick question. Can tenants refuse entry for showings before we get started? Can you give it in 30 seconds or less?
The answer is no. If the showings have already, if they've announced that they're moving out, then they have no right to refuse at any time. In fact, you could show up at 8 o'clock at night by law. I wouldn't recommend it, because you're going to create animosity and you know, angst. But the law says you can do that if they've given notice. If they have not given notice, then you have to give them 24 hours written notice, at which point they cannot refuse. If they do refuse, you would have to go to either the Rental Housing Enforcement Unit, RHEU, well, not either, because forget the LTB, you're not going to get anything out of those people. So I would contact the RHEU, and they will contact the tenants and read them the riot act.
Perfect. Thanks, Chris. So now we're at 10:02. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. We're going to get started. I want to welcome Chris Sapier for being able to do this webinar for us. Now, there is no PowerPoint presentation per se for those who just joined us. I am recording this verbal webinar. I will share with everyone after it goes. I've asked everyone to mute the microphone so we can hear Chris clear, for there's no interference. At the top, there's a chat box between the time and the there. If you have any questions, I will try and monitor them for Chris depending on when he's chatting. Chris, I'm going to turn my camera off, but I'm still here with you. Put my microphone off, and I turn it over to you. Thank you.
Alrighty then. Good morning, everyone. Angela asked me to speak to you. Well, in fact, I had originally had a course planned, or a presentation planned, to be at your office on May 14th, and of course COVID torpedoed that whole thing. And so Angela said, could we do something like what we're doing today? And this is the first time I've ever done a webinar, so you'll have to excuse my clumsiness if it happens from time to time. Never done one of these before. I may wind up doing a lot of them. The deal that I made was that I would speak for as long as you guys wanted, well, up until 2 hours, I guess. If I could just mention a couple of things which are behind me in the background. And it's not there just for promotional purposes. It's there so that you can't see the mess of my office in the background with all the, you know, my home office stuff. So for those who don't know me, and I expect that would be most of you, I'm a landlord for a decade. I own 81 units, 7 properties, one in Peterborough, which is seniors affordable housing, 5 in Oshawa, and 1 in Brantford. I'm the president of the Landlords Association for Durham Region. I've written 2 books. One is called Landlording in Ontario, which was published about a year ago, and then this one, which we're going to be talking about off and on, I guess, called The Dark Side of Residential Landlording. I also teach a course, and I'm a commercial broker of record, specializing in the purchase and sale of apartment buildings. That's all I do. So that's sort of the, I teach a 6 Saturday course as well, or the next one will be in September. So I'm just going to do a little bit of a preliminary discussion, but this is not a lecture. This is an interactive session. And I will attempt to answer any question that you have on any topic related to landlording in the global sense, except if you have a very specific issue that I feel would require a paralegal or a lawyer, I'm going to beg off and say that I'm not licensed. Now, I'll answer that question as a landlord, but I can't and won't provide legal advice. If it turns out to be too detailed, then I would also say, let's take it offline and you can call me. And if you want, I'll provide my contact details during the course of this presentation. So just to get things started, I'm going to talk about two things quickly. And then I'll open it up to everyone. Quickly, probably 5 minutes. The first is that if you're a realtor and you're going to be providing tenant placement services for a landlord, one of your clients, it is likely that you're going to be charging anywhere from 3/4 to 1 month's rent for that service. And I have to tell you that I get a great many phone calls in the last, I'd say, 6 months, disproportionate to all the time before that, from realtors and even tenants who have misjudged the complexity of that service. So last night, I just quickly wrote down, and that's why I'm looking to my right a little bit, I have another monitor. I wrote down a list of some of the legislations that I have run into in the course of my job as an active landlord. Residential Tenancies Act, first and foremost, if you don't know that, don't do this job. You absolutely, positively must know the RTA before you place tenants. And I don't mean know every single word, but the most common things that that take place, like the question that was asked about access. Human Rights Code, the RICO's insurance will not cover claims from a Human Rights Code violation. You may think that you are providing the duty of, what do they call it, the duty of skill and something, competence, I can't remember the exact phrase, I'm sorry, duty and care, duty of skill and care. And a landlord might say to you, well, I don't want anyone who's not working. They must have a job, they must have a car. You know, there's obvious things like, you know, they can't say, well, you know, they have to be from this country, or they have to speak perfect English, or they, you know, they can't be students. All of those things are Human Rights Code violations. And just because the landlord said, I don't want that, and you think you're following their lawful instruction, in fact, it's not lawful. And you will be sued, most likely. You could try and go after the landlord, but you know the complications of that, you know, suing your client is not a good way to run business. Condominium Act, if you're renting or assisting with condos, obviously. Municipal bylaws is a big piece of all of this business, and you'll run into that even when placing tenants. I can't tell you the number of times that tenants have caused mold, for example. They'll air dry their laundry in the living room, they'll get mold, and then they'll complain to us that there's mold and that we should remedy that. I'll say, no, you created it. They'll call the bylaw people. The bylaw people will say, that's your job to fix. And I'll say, okay, tenant, I'm going to fix it. Here's the bill. And that's legal. And that usually results in the tenant not paying the bill and then moving out, which is not necessarily a bad thing either. Building permits you'll run into. PIPEDA, which is the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act. You've got to know that. If you don't, you're setting yourself up for trouble. In particular, laws for, an update was done to PIPEDA in November of 2018. And you'd be astonished at what you can't do. You may all think that you have the right to go and call the last landlord and the second last landlord, for example, and get a reference. Well, yes, you have that right, but the person who's giving that reference, if they didn't get that permission from their tenant, then you are you're in trouble if you provide that that referral and the tenant finds out. You cannot provide a reference unless you've gotten permission, which is one of the clauses that you got to have in your tenancy agreement. And you also want to have a clause in your application form that says the same thing. You cannot take video, for example, if you install surveillance. You need the permission of the tenants. Now, there is some precedence in law that says that you can, there's an implied acceptance when you put the cameras in, but under no circumstances can a camera point into a particular tenant's unit. It can point down the hall, it can be outside. You can probably get away with that. There wouldn't be a problem with it. Most tenants would welcome it. But if you think that you're going to point it into a tenant's unit to find out what they're doing inside, don't. And probably the most surprising of all is that you would think that all the information that's available on the internet, so you go and look on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and start collecting information about the tenant and, you know, to get an idea of who they are. Well, yes, all that information is public, but only for the intended use for which it was published. In other words, for Facebook and those other sites. If you start to pull that information together without the permission of the tenant, then you're aggregating data and creating a compilation that provides an insight or a profile, and that's against the law. So you need permission. You can also only keep the information that you've collected for the time and purpose for which it was collected. So if you're doing it on an application form to determine whether or not they should be allowed to, whether or not you want to have them as a tenant, then as soon as you have made that decision, whether you've accepted or declined, you're required by PIPEDA to destroy that information. Unless you wrote something in your lease, in your tenancy agreement, that says, oh, I'm sorry, I'll stop rocking. my seat is squeaking. Lost my train of thought. PIPEDA, oh yes, you have to destroy that information once you have used it for the purpose for which it was intended. So you need to have in your tenancy agreement, and again in your application form, a clause that says you're going to hold on to this information for the purposes of ensuring that the tenant will keep their keep their obligations and responsibilities during the term of the tenancy, and I've added for my own reasons plus 1 year thereafter. So let's see, so that's PIPEDA, Privacy Act, Environmental Protection Act. I'm not going to talk about all of these, it would take days. You may not even be aware, but there's a Dog Owners Liability Act, and I've used that a few times for obvious reasons, dog owners not taking care of their pets and causing damage and so on. Fire code is a big one. You're going to be hit with that left, right, and center all the time. I just got hit last week again with a new building. Electrical code, building code, health code, criminal code. I had one tenant who said, where's all my stuff? He said, well, we sold it because you hadn't paid your rent for 2 months and we declared the unit vacant. He says, well, I couldn't contact you because I was in jail. Well, that's a long story. But anyway, you've got to know the criminal code and, you know, what your obligations are under the Residential Tenancies Act with respect to that kind of, they call it abandonment of the unit. Natural Gas Code, the Income Tax Act, Ontario Business Corporations Act. If you're going to incorporate companies, you need to know that stuff, and you're going to raise money to do these things. Safe Drinking Water Act, Sustainable Water and Sewage Systems Act, Limitations Act. I've run into the Limitations Act a few times. corporate law, tax law, criminal law, rent control. That's going to be the bane of your existence. Various Canadian Standard Association CSA codes, especially the electrical code, TSSA codes, most often because of oil tanks and so on. And then, of course, municipal licensing. So, that's the kind of stuff that you would need to know as a landlord. And if you're going to provide a duty of care and skill to your clients, they're going to be looking to you to wade those mine-infested waters. And I see that there are a bunch of questions coming in. So let me start taking a look at them. Christopher, does the inclusion in your application and terms and agreement to lease offer signed by the applicant authorize the giver of the reference? No, it does not. You, as the person who are giving the information, oh, well, you know what? That may be a point of law. I would not rely upon it, because the person who's going to send me the information is going to be the new landlord, and I don't know who the new landlord is. I don't know what their background is. I don't know if they've maybe made up the form, for example. I'm not saying that all landlords would do that, but you know, different landlords, well, you know, it runs the full gamut of moral compass, if you will. I hope I answered that question. Pepita clause you're referring to, isn't that already in the standard Ontario lease? Nope, it is not. Especially the stuff that I've just told you about. None of that's in there. I have a client who rents out the main floor of his home, and he lives in the basement. He is getting married in the fall and wants to occupy the entire home. What's his right? So that's a long question, and that talks about repossession of the unit for the landlord's purpose, and it's been a major topic in the media as well, because there are so few means by which to evict a tenant anymore that this particular use, landlord's own use facility, has been abused badly. And the politicians and tenant associations, the media, are all jumping all over this. But legally, if you're going to use that property for your own purposes, or for your caregiver, or for a direct family member, a sibling or a child, for example, or your grandparent or your parents, then I believe, I've never done it, so you'll need to find the exact information, but I believe you have to give the tenant 4 months' notice. And if you enact that, then you must provide 1 month's rent. Why they did that? Pure tenant vote pandering. There's no legal reason or financial reason for doing it. Also, if someone is buying the property, one of your clients is buying the property and wants vacant possession, the seller should be giving, or sorry, the buyer should be giving the seller a clause that says, we as the buyer are going to move in. That way, the seller is then off the hook, as well as the real estate rep. They won't be accountable if the buyer doesn't move in, and that 1 month's rent doesn't have to be paid. Let's see. Can tenants who are staying in a place that's for sale claim fear of catching COVID to refuse entry for showings? That is beyond my level of competence. I can't answer that question. I've not had it happen. I've got currently 5 vacancies, and all of my tenants are working through and applying the premise of social distancing. In some cases, the tenants have gone out. In other cases, they wait in the hallway or go out, you know, on the lawn and wait until the people go in. It's usually a five, or for apartment buildings, it's a 5 minute or a 10 minute, you know, tour. Whether or not they could deny it, there is no legal precedents I'm aware of, but these are unprecedented times. So I guess you'd have to call the Rental Housing Enforcement Unit and ask them how they're handling that. Can a tenant, in my case a student, refuse to pay rent due to COVID? Absolutely not. I've had three tenants out of the 81 that I have who said, I'm not paying you because Premier Doug said I don't have to. And that's not what he said. He said that if you have to choose between buying food and paying the rent, buy food. That's all he said. It's been misinterpreted. Most tenants know that and have been respectful of that. I had five tenants who I call the usual suspects, not because of COVID, but simply because they are profiteers, self-serving, mean-spirited, whatever. Perhaps the most neutral appellation would be they feel entitled. And I've evicted two of those. I've applied for evictions for two of those. Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies about rocking the chair. It's
that's just me, Chris.
I know. It's my brain.
You
when I'm thinking, you know, I'm moving.
I know.
But
that's our
but
human,
that's fine.
Human
just
reaction.
Keep on sending a message and I'll try and stop. So
yeah,
oh, you know what? I'm gonna lock whoops. I pushed along. Hang on a second. I'm gonna lock my chair. Let's see if I can do that. Nope, this chair doesn't have a lock. It has up and down, but it doesn't have a lock. Anyway, I'll try and sit upright and not move. Alright, next question. Can they refuse to take possession due to university classes now being online? No, if they signed a contract and they've made a commitment, a legal commitment, regardless of what their circumstances are for not meeting that commitment, they still have that obligation. Now, having said that, there's the reality of the world, and if they're not going to take possession because you know, they're taking their classes online and not going to pay you, you've just got to make a decision that are you going to sue them you know, prosecute them. You cannot do it in the LTB, landlord tenant board, or LTB also means other things like leave tenants be, or license the butcher, or listens to tenants, you know, loves tenants best. Little joke. Let's see. You'd have to prosecute in the small claims court, and you'd have to show loss of income, because the LTB and small claims court do not have the authority to provide punitive damages. Punitive means punishment. So you may have seen court cases or watched movies where some individual launches a class action lawsuit against a company for environmental, and they get $3 million in damages and $150 million in punitive damages. Well, that $150 million was meant to be a punishment to discourage anyone else from ever doing that to others. Punitive damages cannot be awarded in the LTB, in the LTB or small claims court. So if you were going to go to small claims court, all you could collect was the money that you didn't get until you can lease up again. And if you lease up that unit again in a month or two, then that's all you would get. You get the 2 months rent when it was empty. So, you know, the reality is you wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't, anyway. Are evictions being awarded now? No. The LTB is still closed. I think that's the list of questions that I've got so far. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on what's been occurring with me on COVID over the last 3 months. Obviously, in March, when they put in the emergency measures, everybody was really concerned about what was going to happen in April. For me personally, I went back and looked at my numbers. Pardon me. Out of the 81 tenants I had, 8 asked for COVID-related assistance. They were good tenants. I never had problems with them before. They told me what I wanted to know, and that is, please send me an email or some kind of documentation that from your employer that shows me your current status. Those 8 people did that. I also asked them to show me that they've applied for EI. That's right, EI, employment insurance, or a CERB, or both. And they would do that. And then I asked them to tell me what they could live with. And those 8 tenants did that. The 5 usual suspects said, get lost, we're not giving you anything, we're not telling you anything, we're not paying you anything. And to them, I wrote a very detailed email saying that essentially you have the obligation to pay that. You may think that you've got a short-term gain, but you will have to pay that money or you will be evicted. That's sort of the short version of a long email. One tenant passed away out of the 81 I had. And of course, your first suspicion is COVID, but it turns out not to be the case. He was dealing with cancer. The 5 usual suspects, one wrote asking me what I was going to do for them. So I wrote back and said, it doesn't work like that. You tell me what you need and I'll tell you if I can work with you to accommodate that. All the rest of the tenants paid on before the first of the month. And 3 of the buildings, this is April, so this is the first month in which we're being super concerned. And all the tenants in 3 of the 7 buildings paid on or before the first of the month. So, sorry. I turned off my phone, but it doesn't stop my, you know what, I should turn it right off. Just bear with me a second. I'll power it off. So all the rest of the tenants paid on or before the first of the month. In May, I had 4 COVID-related requests, but all of them paid before the end of the month. And at that point in May, I filed eviction notices for 3. Not because I can get the eviction, but because I wanted to be in the queue so that when the evictions opened up again, I wouldn't be in that mass of people who are applying for evictions later on. As it happens, 2 of those tenants have subsequently moved out. Yay! They owe me $3,500 each. I'll turn that over to the collection agency, but I got rid of troublesome tenants and I'll replace them with good ones. And then in June, which just happened a couple days ago, I have 1 COVID-related request. As I mentioned, 2 of the evictions moved out of their own accord. I have 1 eviction remaining. He's obstinate, I guess. And then, most interesting thing that happened, though, is that between May and June, I've had 5 tenants announce that they were moving. So that is unprecedented. I don't usually have that kind of mass exodus. It's always, you know, maybe 1 or 2, and I might have 10 in a year out of the 81. So, let's see, any other questions? With commercial unit, if your tenant does not wish you to sign up for the Commercial Tenancy Assistance Program, do you have to sign up for it? That is a legal question that I don't feel comfortable answering. I'm going to leave it at that. I have some thoughts on it, but because we're in an open forum, you know, amongst many people, and this isn't really about commercial units, it's about multi-residential or residential tenancy. I do have a background in commercial, and I have some thoughts on it, but it's not based on legal insight. How do I turn over a tenant debt to a collection agency? But just call them up, open up an account. I looked at about 5 collection agencies. I chose one. I don't know if I'm... Angela, is it okay to mention the company, or should I just leave it open?
It's up to you if you want to mention it.
Okay.
But
So I went to about five different collection agencies, and the one I chose is based out of Hamilton, by coincidence, not by choice. Remember, most of my properties are in Durham. But I found the president of this company to be really proactive, aggressive. They've got online capability, so you can actually log in and look at the status of your cases. And that company is called Go Beyond Collections. And they're based in Hamilton. I don't have their number off the top of my head. All right. Well, I can talk forever about all kinds of stuff. I don't know. Give me some direction. What do you want to talk about?
Chris, keep going on about what you and I had. And I see one more question came in.
I'm sorry, you broke up there a little bit. Could you repeat that?
Yeah. Sorry, Chris. One more question come in. Answer and then continue on.
Okay, well, all the questions I see here, I think I've answered. Did I miss anybody?
The last one.
How do I turn over a tenant? Oh, sorry, I didn't scroll. All right, sorry. All right, if you make an arrangement with the tenant to pay less or defer temporarily until reemployed, can you still expect full payment of the rest? Yes, 100%. Absolutely. You're not even required by law to accommodate. The law says that you are entitled as the landlord to collect the full rent when it is due by the method that was agreed upon at the location that was agreed upon. If you did not write a tenancy agreement, then the default is the Residential Tenancies Act. And ironically, when I was writing the second book, I went and looked to find out what that default payment is, and I thought it would be a check, naturally. Because there are actually over 30 references to not paying by check, but there's nothing in the RTA that says that you must pay by check. And in fact, in the RTA it says you as a landlord cannot force a tenant to use post-dated checks or to pay by online. It specifically says that, but it doesn't say what your options are, so the default would be cash. And if you get paid cash, you're asking for trouble. I guarantee it. Do not do that, ever. Well, try to avoid it whenever possible, and if you do have to get paid by cash, get paid by cash in a very public place. Can you imagine having a 25-unit property, being paid $1,000 a month for each unit, and the tenants know that you're carrying around $25,000 in your pocket on the first or second? That's not a good place to be, even if you think you can take on any challenge. Don't do it. So, in your tenancy agreement, you want a clause that specifically states the landlord and the tenant agree that they will pay by, and for me, I have two methods. One is called tenant pay, but I'm weaning off of that. I'm not using it as much anymore. And you can go look them up. And the other one is by e-transfer. And I just have all my tenants pay by e-transfer. That's all my new tenants. Now, the ones I've inherited out of the 81 tenants I've got seven tenants who pay by post-dated checks, by their choice. Post-dated checks aren't so bad now because you can deposit by telephone. And that's been a real boon. Without the telephone, I'd be irked every time I have to process those things. I hate checks. So yes, a tenant must pay whatever they owe, and it's up to you as to when you feel the tenant is no longer being honorable and they're not paying, or you feel that you're getting past the level of risk that you want to accept. At that point, you have to file an N-4, Notice 4. That says that the tenant has 14 days to comply and pay, after which you as a landlord can apply for an eviction, which is called an L1. But with COVID, be reasonable. If you think that COVID doesn't matter and tenants are trying their best and they demonstrate to an adjudicator that they were doing the best under the circumstances and you didn't make any effort, you will be hung out to dry, not the tenant. And it may backfire. They may even give a rent payment So be prudent and reasonable in your decision as to how far to go with arrears, rent arrears. Any reason we shouldn't send out notices of a rent increase? Nope. I did it in April, I did it in May, I did it in June. It's 3 months away. Who knows what's going to happen in 3 months? In 3 months, if they come back and say, look, I'm struggling, then you'll make a decision at that time. But that's your prerogative, not theirs. I still sent out N1s, I sent out N4s, and I sent out L1s, as I've mentioned. Because of COVID, I've held off sending the notices of rent increase. Well, that's a socially responsible thing to do, which of course just means I was being socially responsible by sending them out. But I look at it this way. If you know anything about cap rates and how they impact on net operating income, let me give you a simple example. Let's say a tenant, you've got five tenants, well, I have 81 tenants, and if I don't increase the rent, say by the 2.2%, which would an average, say $25, and I've got four tenants, that's $100. So $100 a month doesn't seem like very much, and it's socially acceptable. But you take that $100 times 12 is $1,200, and divide that by a 5% cap rate, that's $24,000 in lost equity. $24,000 for not sending out the N1 at that time. So it has a profound impact. I have a phrase that I teach in class that says $1 of NOI, or $1 of net operating income, is $20 of joy, or OI if you screw up. Your electricity bill goes up by $1,000 a year, you've lost $20,000 in equity value at a 5 cap, and many properties are trading below a 5 cap these days. So, sorry for the long-winded answer, but I thought I'd be as complete as I can. And you're welcome, Steve. I think that was the last question I had there. I was talking before we got started, briefly, about something that just happened last week. When you apply for a mortgage and you get it insured by CMHC, historically, before interest rates, fell so low, you could see as much as a 200 basis point difference between a conventional mortgage that's not insured and a insured mortgage with CMHC. 200 basis points is 2%. So, in a market where 5% was the norm for interest, you could get 3% that was insured by CMHC. Now, with the drop in interest rates, being the lowest in living memory, that spread is no longer there. But it can't stay that way forever. And of course, we've been saying that for a decade. Sooner or later, those interest rates have got to go back up. And I would think that within 5 years they might. So if you're insuring today at 2%, let's say you get a phenomenal deal. I just closed a refinancing at 1.8, a 5-year close fixed. Now that's fantastic today, but 5 years from now, if that interest rate went up to 3.6, then it doesn't matter what I'm paying today, the amount of money, right now it's $12,000 a month. I'm going to have to pay $24,000 a month 5 years from now. Will my property income have gone up or doubled to cover that? Probably not. And if that's the case, then you could be facing a very difficult time in refinancing. You might have to come up with your own money. You may even be negative cash flowing at that point. The reason I mention all of this is because CMHC, in its infinite wisdom, announced on May 28th that they were no longer going to insure mortgages for multi-residential properties where that money has not been declared for its use, where the use of that money has not been declared. In other words, if you want to take that money out because you've spent the last 5 years working your butt off at marginal income. So you can now take your round the world trip in your sailboat and extract that money from the equity of your property. CMHC will not insure it. So you cannot take money out for the purposes of, it's not an equity withdrawal for the purposes that don't relate to either buying a new property or construction and renovations. So our retirement plans have been torpedoed big time by CMHC. And the reason that they did that was, I spoke with somebody at CMHC yesterday or day before, and they said they were going after the REITs, the real estate investment trusts. Sorry, let me see if any other questions have come in here because I'm rambling on. No, okay. The reason that they did that was because the real estate investment trusts, especially the ones that have commercial properties at retail, well, retail was taking a beating before COVID came along, and we all know the status of retail today. I think a lot of, well, probably half of all the restaurants that existed will disappear by the time this thing is over. And the retail REITs are going to take a bath. So what they've all done is they all applied, and there were over 500 applications in the last couple of months from REITs for the purposes of extracting equity. The reason they did that, and this is my conjecture now, CMHC didn't say this, and it's not official, but the reason that they would have done it from my perspective is that they're taking all the equity out so that if they do foreclose, there isn't much left in the portfolio that you would have any recourse on. And the banks would say, well, you know, don't worry about it. I'll just get the money from the government, which means you and me and all the taxpayers are paying for those REITs who got massacred. So if you think spending a few billion dollars these past couple of months in just dealing with emergency funds is an issue, wait till you see the backlash from trillions of dollars that are supposed to be insured through CMHC, backed by government bonds. Anyway, so that was my little diatribe on that. I did speak with an officer, a regional manager of CMHC, and I passed along my concerns and said, I don't understand why you can't just pass a policy that says anyone that has more than, pick a number, 300 units can't extract equity, but the rest of us small to medium operators should have that right. And she said she would pass that along. So we'll see what happens over the next 30 days. How about giving me some guidance on what you want to hear, what you want to talk about?
Hey, Chris, there's no questions right now, but I'm sure if you just keep giving them some tidbits.
Okay, so let me go through some of the clauses then. I have 78 extra clauses that I've added to the tenancy agreement, because the tenancy agreement, the standard Ontario tenancy agreement, in my opinion, is probably 90% pro-tenant, 10% landlord. And it is missing a huge number of really important topics that you could be faced with. And the first one that comes to mind is guarantors. You'll note that there's no provision for a guarantor in the tenancy agreement. And the reason for that is that the LTB has no jurisdiction over guarantors. The LTB has an exclusive jurisdiction over only over current tenants. If a tenant has moved out, you can't prosecute the tenant through the LTB. You have to go to small claims court. If they've done some damage to your unit, and you want to collect those damages, you got to go to small claims court. If you get a guarantor to sign a guarantor's agreement, the way that process would work, and I still do it, but more carefully now, what would happen is that you would have to go to the LTB and demonstrate that the tenant had not met their obligations under the Tennessee agreement. Once you got that judgment, you could then go to small claims court with that judgment, with the breached Tennessee agreement, and with your separate guarantor agreement. It cannot be part of the Tennessee agreement. It has to be a separate agreement. And with that separate agreement, you would have an appendix, and the appendix would be the lease agreement. And the guarantor agreement basically says, I, as a guarantor, will guarantee the performance of the roles and responsibility of the tenant named in this in the attached tenancy agreement. And then once that tenant has breached, you got the judgment, then you can go to the small claims court and collect from small claims. You would likely win, but then what? Now you have to collect. And both the LTV and small claims court have no provision for the collection of awards. You have to go find that guarantor. You have to serve them yourself or hire a process a server, a company. And then you'd have to apply for the garnishment of wages or whatever other vehicles might be available to you. In other words, you're not going to do it. Not even for $3,000 or $4,000. I won't for $3,000 or $4,000. And I would never let it get to $10,000 or $15,000. As soon as the tenant, I have a policy. That's another thing. So, and all the tenants know it. Part of my introduction letter, when I take over a building or when a new tenant moves in, it says that we have a very clear policy on rent payment. You owe it on the first of the month in full. If you can't, as soon as you know that you can't, call me and we'll work something out. If you don't contact me, then on the second of the month, I will send out a friendly reminder, typically an email, but it could be a phone call, a text message. But I don't like to do that. I prefer emails because they're trackable and they're admissible in court. And if I don't hear anything on the second, I issue an N-4 on the third. And the reason you do that is because you can't start the process of eviction or collections until that M4 is issued. So when I send the M4, I say, don't take it personally. The LTV forces us to follow this procedure in order to protect our rights. And you write a friendly letter. Now, in subsequent cases where the tenant is just difficult or challenging, I don't do that. I just send an M4 on the second of the month. In fact, I tried to deliver at 6 a.m. on the second of the month. The superintendent is up early, just to prove a point. It's really important that they understand that they don't get 2 weeks of free grace period. And I get that all the time. I actually have to go to court once. The very first court case I ever had with the LTV was a tenant who absolutely refused to pay the rent on the first because he had the right. Just out of no reason, it had nothing to do with funding. He did this every month, despite my repeated warnings. And then he was told in no uncertain terms, and he signed an agreement, that he would pay on time. And he did after that. So that's guarantors. We talked about Pepita. Smoking. Pets. Let's talk about pets, because that's often misunderstood. Everybody thinks, we won't talk, I'll talk, you'll listen. Write a question. Pets. Everybody believes that, including tenants, that it's against the law to deny a tenant application because they have a pet. And that's incorrect. It's wrong. The only thing that the Residential Tenancies Act says, and it's a single sentence, it says that a clause in the tenancy agreement that prohibits a pet is void. That's it. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if they bring a pet in after they've moved and you had a no pets clause, then you can't evict them. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that you can't say, no, you've got a pet and I don't want you. And a lot of tenants think that, and I can't tell you how many times I've had to educate a tenant, or an applicant, and say, no, you're wrong. Now, what happens after they move in? Well, in my tenancy agreement, I say you can't have pets, but if you do bring one in, you have to sign a pet agreement. That is a unenforceable clause in court. But here's a key differentiator that you need to understand about my way I do business. And that is, I've written my tenancy agreement to stay out of the LTV, not to win in it. Because if you've gotten to the LTV, you're probably going to lose just because of the tenant biases that are in that, not only that organization, but built into the RTA. So I'll do everything I can to resolve the issue before going to the LTV. And I find that the tenants all know that they are responsible for whatever they've signed. So if there's a clause in there and they've signed it and they didn't dispute it, then I can point to clause 44 and say, you agreed to this. Yeah, but I didn't know blah, 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 blah. Well, then you can have a conversation, you've got them on the defensive, and you can usually work something out. Not often, in a couple of cases, I had a tenant who says, well, I'm not signing. And I don't respond, I don't say anything. And in two cases, and I'm not advocating you do this, I'm telling you this is what I've done. Everyone has to find their own comfort zone in the line that differentiates the law from the unlawful. And it's a big, thick, gray line. I can tell you, if you followed every single piece of legislation that you're required to do to the letter of the law, you will go bankrupt. And I have no problem defending that argument if anybody challenged me on it. Having said that, that means there's a big, thick, gray line about what you feel responsible you need to do in order to manage your business, do the right thing in terms of the law and just by your own moral code, but also be financially liable. Having said that, in one case, a tenant came back and said, who had a cat and lied to me and said they didn't have one, and then she wrote some bogus email that said, my sister-in-law has to move and I'm the only person that she can give the cat to. And I said, no, you can give it to the Humane Society, you can put it up on Kijiji. There's 100 other things you could do. Well, not 100, but there was a few. And she said, well, I'm keeping the cat. So nothing happens. And about 6 months later, she writes and says, I need a parking spot. And I wrote back and said, do you still have the cat? And I never heard from her again. In a second situation, I had a tenant who had given me grief. And then literally a couple of days after she had called in the bylaw department for some infraction, that's a longer story. I feel I was in the right. In any case, she then says, I need my rent receipt. So I took my time, because the people who need rent receipts usually want them for their for their personal income tax return, and they want to file their income tax return, and it's usually something that has to be done fairly quickly while they've got their head wrapped around it, so they want the receipt the next day. So I wrote back and I said, we only do this twice a month. You're required by law to provide one. It doesn't say you have to do it the next day. So, you find your little wins, in those ways. And maybe they'll be a little more respectful the next time. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think I saw a question come in.
Yeah, Chris, there's 4 questions.
Okay.
Danielle.
Okay.
Should you put
guarantors as a tenant? There's a court case in the 1990s under the precursor to the Residential Tenancies Act. I think it was called the act. It doesn't matter. Anyway, there was a court precedent that said where they actually did that. They made the guarantor a tenant. And the adjudicator said, do you live there? The guarantor said, no, but. And the adjudicator said, if you don't live there, you're not a tenant. So the answer is no. You won't win that. That has been time-tested, and you would lose. Your only option, if you're going to use a guarantor, is to have a separate guarantor agreement. Mine's about 3 pages. That guarantees that tenancy. Let's see. Ask if they had a tenant, said no. As soon as they took possession, they brought in a puppy. Yeah. So they lied. So you write an email and say, you know, that's not a good way to start a tenancy relationship. And you leave it at that. There's nothing you can do. Your hands are tied. Well, there are things you can do that I can't mention. Like I said, you know, there's a balancing of the scales, but it's a long-term play. That doesn't mean, however, that if they bring in a pet and it causes damage, they're still responsible for all that damage, even if they don't have an agreement. Your tenancy agreement should have a clause in there, and the RTA says it anyway, that a tenant is responsible for any damages that are not due to normal wear and tear or infrastructure failure. So if the cat chews up the carpet with their claws, or the urine, cat urine is absolutely pungent, you might have to rip up all the carpet to put in a new carpet. You can charge the tenant that. But remember, they're not going to pay while they're there. They will dispute it. Then they'll find a place to move, and then you're going to have to go to small claims court. And that's the issue. You've got no recourse. How come condos can have a no pet policy? Because the condo owners all went to war with the government. They lobbied for that, and the corporation the board on behalf of the corporation is a voice for all of the owners, and because they're owners and not renters, the owners have a say, I would presume. But basically it was built into condo legislation. Sorry, that's not true. It was not built into condo legislation. It was a court case that changed condo legislation so that they could do that. My understanding is that I can't evict if they get a pet after living in the unit. That is correct. And I think I just I answered that question earlier. A paralegal just told me to do that. Sorry, Daniel, I'm not sure. Should you put a guarantor as a tenant? A paralegal just told me to do that. Well, then, I mean, they're licensed, I'm not. But I'm telling you that it is my understanding, and I think you will discover that if you, my answer to you is go and talk to 2 more paralegals and see what answer you get. Because I'm pretty damn sure that paralegal is wrong. Pardon my language. That's all I'm going to say about that. Because now we're getting to the issue of law. But go and get a second and third opinion. What else? Smoking. So, I can't tell you how many times tenants have told me, I have a right to smoke. And this would now apply, especially to marijuana. I have the right to smoke. The government passed a law that says I can smoke marijuana. Yes, the government also said you can drink alcohol. The government further said you can't drink alcohol while you're operating heavy equipment or driving a car. And of course, you would not smoke marijuana while drinking, smoking, operate a vehicle while smoking. That's common sense. But they say, well, this isn't about that. This is about being able to, you know, I'm queen or king of my castle. And that's not correct. Just because you have a right to do it doesn't mean you have a right to do it anywhere you want and anytime you please. That is the point. So if they say, I want to smoke marijuana, they have no legal... Well, let me be careful about this. There is no reason why someone has to smoke marijuana in order to get the medicinal benefits. You can get those same pain relieving benefits from oil, capsules, pills, and patches. And in fact, the problem with smoking marijuana is that you can't control the dose. A doctor isn't going to say, smoke 3 joints a day. They're going to say, take this pill once a day or twice a day for pain. Smoking marijuana, the pain-relieving benefits enter the bloodstream immediately because they go through the lungs. And you will feel the pain-relieving effects within about 15 minutes, but it only lasts about an hour. Taking a pill or an oil, or ingesting in some other way, a patch, it takes about an hour because it has to go through your stomach and your intestinal system to be processed. Sorry, gastrointestinal system to be processed. It takes about an hour for you to feel those pain-relieving effects, but it lasts for about 8 hours. So there's no medical justification for smoking marijuana, especially in a unit. And there is no, despite, and this is what really upset me about the standard lease agreement that came, that the provincial government put out, they actually have a clause, not a clause, but a statement, I can't remember if it's R or S, something like that, in their appendix that says that landlords must comply with the Human Rights Code provisions for smoking. They don't tell you what they are, they just imply that smokers have that right, and they don't. What that clause was, and I spoke with the person who wrote that standard lease agreement on behalf of the government, and he said, well, you know, we have to follow the instructions of our political masters, but what they're referring to specifically there is the Human Rights Code recognizes the right to smoke for religious purposes, specifically First Nations. Now, I've not ever had, in the 10 years that I've been an operator and the hundreds of tenancies I've had, once had a tenant who said, by the way, I'm exercising my right under the Human Rights Code as a First Nation member to be able to smoke. And I would be required by law to accommodate him, unless I found another suitable candidate at the same time. There is actually a court case where an individual who was an inmate in Her Majesty's prison had filed a breach of their right to smoke in prison because they suffered from withdrawal symptoms and other things. And that court case came out and the judge said unequivocally that the state has no obligation to pander to the rights of smokers. Smokers, while it may be difficult, can wean themselves off without medical help. You know, while it may be challenging, I think Mark Twain said that it's easy to quit smoking. I've done it 100 times. So, you know, that sort of speaks to how difficult it can be. In any event, that that court case specifically said that the prison had not taken away the smoking rights as punishment, but to improve the health of everyone else around them, and that it wasn't that difficult to quit smoking, and that if he had any withdrawal symptoms, it was because of other substance abuse, not because of smoking. And that became the precedent. So you can stop people from smoking, in a unit before they move in. After they've moved in, if they've signed a no smoking clause, then you can actually prosecute. And with the new legislation, the LTV is empowered to evict. Before that, the only way you could really do anything is go after them for damages. And yeah, like that's going to happen. All right, sorry, I'm rambling on again. Let me see if any new questions have come in. What I've done in the past was make the guarantor the tenant, and they sublease the unit to the actual tenant who's living in the unit, making the guarantor fully responsible. Yeah, but then they're not a guarantor, they are a sub-landlord, right? And they're operating under, what do you call it? It's not the assignment, it's the other one. Sorry, I forget the word. You're not assigning the obligation, you're just subletting. Sorry, you're subletting. And there's a whole set of rules for that. So yes, you could do that. I wouldn't. I'd rather just not, deal with it. But that's a personal preference. I think that would work. Steve, you're welcome. I'm glad to have helped. And Danielle. Yeah. Okay. What else can we talk about? What other big challenges do you see?
Chris, do you have any that's not been covered? Anything else with the COVID and what you see moving now and in the future? Something that you chatted about?
Yeah. Well, what's going to happen with COVID? What is COVID going to do to the marketplace? I mean, that's one of the questions I get all the time. I guess we should talk about that. From my opinion, I've like I said, I've had 5 vacancies, which surprised me. But I'm also still experiencing a high volume of people who are applying. I still get a large number of applicants. In the past, I was getting between 50 and 60 inquiries and probably 5 or 6 applications before COVID. During COVID in April, it dropped off precipitously, but right now it's almost back to normal here in June. I leased up 3 units during my COVID period, so which meant that they had to come and take tours and look at the unit and sign contracts and meet, that type of thing, practicing social distancing. So that's happened. What do I personally think will happen to real estate value, property values? So there's really at least 2 parts to this. If the property has 4 more units, that's one discussion. If it's a single family home, I believe that's a different discussion. Airbnb is going to be devastated. People who have Airbnb were making great money. The city was, many municipalities were going after them because of the impact it had not only on the established hotel accommodation industry, but also on rental housing, because all of those units were being taken out of the rental pool. So municipalities were already passing laws before that time. With COVID, it's virtually died. So I can see a lot of Airbnb furnished units becoming available on the market. However, there's a massive pent-up demand for single-family homes, both condos and houses, bungalows and so on. And it remains to be seen whether prices will go down. And I know we've seen listing prices go down. I'm not so sure that sale prices have dropped that much. I still think there'll be multiple offers on properties that are well priced and they will still sell at market or whatever, with 2 qualifiers. The first qualifier is that most owners of real estate have been given up to 6 months to refinance. So I don't see any immediate backlash if landlords have the guts to ride this out and take a chance and just delay their mortgage payments by a few months. If this COVID thing goes on through September or October, then that's going to be a different ballgame. We're going to see a lot of forfeitures. And while we almost historically never see foreclosures in Canada, it's always powers of sale, I could see an increasing number of, not even foreclosures, but just quit deeds. People who walk away and say, here, it's yours. And they sign away the deed. That may happen if this goes on longer. Single family homes, the same story. While they, if they're being rented out and the tenants aren't paying, so the tenants are staying and the mortgage payments are coming in at $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 a month, you're going to have to sell that house. The problem is going to be, if the tenant is in there and they haven't paid the rent and you're a buyer, are you going to buy a house with a tenant who hasn't paid the rent? No. Are the prices going to drop? Well, even if you offered the house at, you know, 30% below what it's worth, would you still buy it? Well, if you have deep pockets, you might. That's a risk. It's a chance. You could evict. You carry. How long is it going to take for evictions? A year. That's my prediction today. It's going to take a year. Why? Because the LTV was broken before COVID came along. And they're just absolutely dysfunctional now. They're not doing anything for landlords. And even tenants are taking between 3 and 4 months for a tenant application to be processed. Multi-res, which I would say 4 or more units, maybe a triplex, but 4 or more units, I don't see anything happening. For most people, there's going to be no need to sell. Even before this happened, there was no need to sell. It was a desirable thing, not a necessary thing. There will be a few people who would sell for, you know, the traditional reasons, a marriage breakup, you know, they want to get out of the business and so on. But anyone who just wants to get out of the business would probably not arbitrarily get out of the business right now. Because the only people who are out there looking to buy these properties are bargain hunters. And I had a property up for sale in March. I sold one, and the second one got sold. It didn't close, and I took it off the market because the only calls I was getting was, well, you know, you must have all kinds of distress problems. Well, even if I did, in your typical 10 or 11 plex, I get my free and clear operational costs is 7. I need 7 units to pay, and 4 don't have to pay, and I would still break even in my operational costs. So I could carry that property for a year or more before I get into financial difficulty, as long as 7 out of my 11 units paid their rent on time. Couple that with the fact that all of the major lenders have allowed up to 6 months for deferral. So within 6 months, I would have either evicted that tenant or they will have paid. And if they evict, while the dark side is that you've lost that cash flow, the bright side is that you're going to be able to increase the rent, right? Market adjustment, which is permitted. That's called vacancy decontrol. They've taken the control of vacancy out of the equation. So if you have a tenant who moved in a year ago, you would think that, well, you know, that's not such a good thing. But I'm telling you, 2 years ago, when a tenant moved out, if they'd been there less than 3 years, my average rent increase might have been $25 a month. I might have gone from $1,000 to $1,025 for a one-bedroom in Oshawa. My one-bedrooms are right now renting out at $1,200. And it's gone up by $200 in the last year and a half, less than 2 years, per month. And those rent increases are going through the roof because nobody is building the supply needed to meet the demand. So I don't see any big opportunities in multi-res. I don't see price decreases. I think the cap rates will continue to trade under 5 and way below that in Toronto proper. So in Toronto, 3.5 cap, which seems absolutely absurd. But if you can get interest rates at 1.8, 3.5 is not so ridiculous. And, well, anyway, I'm, again, rambling on. That's my sort of short version take on what I think will happen. There is a huge amount of people who are still looking to buy a property to move into. There's pent-up demand. With the what they call it, the stress test on mortgages, 200,000 families were locked out of the ability to buy a house because of the stringent stress tests, which have been slowly lessened, I guess. I'm not really tracking that. I don't know. You guys probably know better than I do what's going on there. But my understanding is that they've been less stringent on that. And I expect that there'll be even more of that. So there's a huge pent up demand. Those 200,000 people had nowhere to go, so they're still renting. But with all of this, well, with COVID, I can see those people finally having an opportunity to move out and get into those places, and possibly cheaper than they would have before COVID. I don't know if that helps or not, but those are sort of my off the top, you know, thoughts. So let's see, where have you found the best platform to advertise vacancies that bring you the most applications and quality tenants? Unfortunately, you can't put those two words together in the same sentence. Number of applicants and quality. It's the market that you operate in. I operate in Oshawa and Brantford. They're blue-collar, gray-collar markets. I have a very high decline rate, very high. Most of my advertising is done on Kijiji. I also have a website, and I built my own rent online rent application. If you want to see what it is, because it is public, Rent Apple, www.rentapple.com, rentapple.com. And that's what I use. I built that internally myself for my purposes to deal with these exact challenges. So Kijiji. Now, I have a lady who takes care of all the tenant placements, because I hate that job. And she may advertise on a couple of other places, and I just don't know the names of them. But if you want to send me an email, I can find out for you and send that to you. Now, again, in the course, I have many phrases, and another one is better vacant than a claimant, because of the dysfunctional nature of the LTV and the brutal legislation of the RTA and the Human Rights Code, for that matter. I have literally turned down tens of applicants and had a unit empty for 2 months rather than take a marginal tenant. Now, before COVID, I had started experimenting with a company called Neighborly, Naborly.com. And they would actually insure marginal tenants. And I did about six of those before COVID came along. When COVID came along, Neighborly got hammered. I'm not sure they're going to, I don't know what their status is, but I think they may not recover from COVID. Remains to be seen. But without Neighborly and without that marginal tenant insurance capability, I have vacancies that have gone on for a couple months. Can you comment on, one, using the tenant to do landscaping, snow removal? So in that first part, yes, I can. There is court precedence also for that. If you put into your tenancy agreement that a tenant is going to get reduced rent, in exchange they will provide the services of snow removal, take the garbage out, clean the sidewalks, cut the grass, and so on, that's illegal. Well, it's not that it's illegal, it's that it won't be held up in the LTV. The LTV will say, sorry, the RTA specifically states that the landlord is responsible for the health, safety, and maintenance of the property. You cannot pass that responsibility on to the tenant, dot, 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 directly. The answer is, you hire the tenant as an independent contractor. You do not put it into the tenancy agreement, and you do not ask the LTB to enforce that agreement. You create a subcontractor or a contractor agreement, and whether it's the tenant or somebody else, it doesn't matter. Here's what the obligations are. These are your roles, your responsibility, and you pay them separately. Don't give them a rent discount. And there's a second reason for doing that. Let's say instead of paying $1,400, they pay $1,200 a month. That $200 a month, you're not reporting as income. So when you go to refinance your property, you've got $2,400 less income than you should. Now, it doesn't quite work out like that. But from an optics perspective, that $2,400 is $48,000 of equity. It's better if you have a separate contractor agreement that shows the full income of the property, And then you can write off that expense that you've paid to the tenant of that $2,400, which reduces your taxable income, so you pay less tax, you know, at the bottom line. Now, it's actually a wash from an accounting perspective, but you would do this anyway, because if the tenant one day says, I don't want to do this anymore, and you say, well, it's in your tenancy agreement, they'll say, well, so what? It's not binding, and they'd be right. Or they'd find out, and some paralegal or pro bono service would tell you that you're wrong and they're right. So you simply go to the next door neighbor and hire the kids, you know, or hire somebody else, or find somebody else to cut the grass and do the thing, and you just stop paying them their $200 a month, and you're still getting your $1,400. So that's one, points one and two. Before I forget, I also want to say something else about rent penalties. It's against the law to charge a late fee. But the really odd and frankly stupid thing in the Residential Tenancies Act is that you have the right to offer a discount for early payment. So what I've done, and it's a little bit complicated, it's not, you know, it's not cut and dry, you've got to do a spreadsheet. But what I've done is, if I want $1,200 a month for my rental unit, then I advertise it's $1,200 after the early payment discount. So when I fill out the lease form, it's going to say the first and last month's deposits are $2,400 each, but the lawful rent is actually $1,200 divided by 0.98, because the maximum discount that you're allowed to give is 2%. So they will pay, so what would that be? That would be $24 more. So the rent would be $1,224 for the lawful rent, but if they pay on time, they pay $1,200. So if 6 months from now they don't pay on time, you can say, that's okay, instead of paying the $1,200, pay what you're supposed to pay, which is $1,224. And that way you get your payment penalty. So it's a little bit onerous to manage, but it really makes tenants pay on time, because they do pay a penalty as a consequence. So back to your question, Cameron.
Yep. Chris, I just want to jump in for a second.
Sure.
We're at 11:22.
Okay.
And we have one more question we haven't got answered.
Okay. Well, I can do these last two things here. Is that what you want me to do, or?
Yes, please. If you can answer the questions.
Okay. All right, so Cameron, point three, separating parking furniture as an additional base rent. Yes, so, and I do that. I separate out parking. I charge $35 a month for parking. And the reason I do that, separate from the agreement, as a separate fee. Now, there's really two questions there. Is it separate from the agreement? Well, the law says that, the Residential Tenancies Act says that parking is actually part of a rental unit. So whether or not you can actually charge a separate fee independent of the rental agreement, I do that, but I'm not sure if it would hold up in a court of law. So I have a separate parking agreement. And the reason I do that is because if I have an extraordinary expense like I did last year where I have to pay $600 more for salt, I raise my parking agreement by $2, you know, from $35 to $37. But if it was part of the lease agreement, I could only raise that 2.2%, which is a lawful guideline. And the guideline on $35 would be 68 cents or 70 cents, you know. So whether or not you can separate, that's an offline topic if you want to talk about it. But I do charge separately, and the reason I charge separately is because some tenants will say, well, I don't have a car, so I want a discount. So where do you go from there? You have to give them a discount. The other problem is that I have two cars. Well, if you only have one parking spot per unit, which many of these older buildings have, you want to be able to own those parking spaces, not the tenants. So if one tenant doesn't have a parking spot, you could rent that out to the second person. So yes, I definitely charge separately for parking. The benefits of hydro as an extra to the base rent are paid, including. Don't ever, 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 did I say that enough times? Include electricity in your rent. Electricity went up 55% in November 2019. And they hid that with a 31.7% rebate. So if you look at your bill, you'll see that it was my February electricity bill at one building was $4,000. But because of the rebate, it was only $3,000. What happens 2 years from now, or even less than that, because the government just spent billions of dollars and wasn't expecting the COVID, how long do you think that rebate's gonna last? And when that rebate is gone, who's paying for it? Who's gonna absorb that cost? If your electricity bill goes up from $3,000 to $4,000, that's $1,000 a month, let's say, which is $12,000 for the year, which is $140,000 in lost equity, because you're covering the tenant's electricity who couldn't care less about whether or not it's being conserved. Don't ever do that. Okay. And I could rail about that even longer and tell you more things, but we're out of time. So I'll just move on. Neighborly is now charging for tenant verification applications. Yes, I know. That's for the application, not for a final credit check, although they include one in it. And they're charging $25. And I was using Neighborly but only for my final, for the insurance purposes, not so much for the application. As I said, I have my own application process. I have a 22-point process that I go through. Now that they're charging for each application, not even the insurance, they've suspended the insurance. It's not worth it, in my opinion. But that's just me, because I have other methods of dealing with that. I use RentCheck. RentCheck. If you belong to any apartment association, they will give you a steep discount. If you don't belong to an association, and in fact, that steep discount often pays for the cost of belonging to the apartment association. So in my case, I'm paying $23, including HST, for a credit report. And that's it. We're at 11:27. And here, let me just give you contact information. I'm gonna hold this up for a second. Can you read that okay? So that's my email address, my phone number, and some the link for the book, for the course, and for the standard lease clauses, which are available. And if you have any questions about anything that we talked about, I'm always happy to have a question, again, with the qualifier that I'm not a lawyer. And I hope it doesn't sound like too much self-promotion, but that was the deal I made with Angela, is I would do this, for your benefit for an hour and a half in exchange for a quick soft sale, if you will. Please put up the sign again. All right, sorry. Angela is recording this, so you'll be able to get it, or you can contact her, or just do a search on my last name, S-E-E-P-E. There aren't too many of us. There's about 325 in the world, so it won't be too hard to find me.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much. I will make sure that the participants receive all that.
Okay.
I'll send you a copy of the recording and to all participants. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, and I hope it was worth your time.